Mr. Stevens, Reel 3.
Captain Harry Thompson, Marine Howard. Now, he had been my escorting officer to Derna when the mission Fungus took off, originally for Yugoslavia. Anyway, his parents had come up from South Africa, having got out of Yugoslavia, where his father was Secondary Vacancy for Countland in Zagreb before the war, and they'd gone on to Cairo, and he was given permission, given leave to go to Cairo, though, of course, by then, leave to Cairo was stopped in the main. I demanded the same privilege, seeing I'd had no leave for 16 months, and eventually they agreed and let me go with him. He and I spent a month in Cairo enjoying the flesh pots of Egypt. He then went to join his parents somewhere, and I stayed on waiting for special signal stores to go back into Yugoslavia, to the partisans. Eventually, we both came back. Back to Bari for a while, and then it was decided to send me back into Yugoslavia to Zadar, which was an Italian conclave, enclave, I should say, I beg your pardon, an enclave in the Dalmatian coast, given to the Italians after the First World War as part of the reward for changing sides, as they did in the Second World War. Gabriele D'Annunzio, the famous warrior poet of Italy, had demanded some sort of recompense for joining the Allies. And of course they got part of Slovenia as well, and Trieste. However, I went back into Zadar, into Yugoslavia, into Zadar, I think it was either end of March or April 1945. I can't think of the Canadian, of the South African major's name who was in command of the mission. But from there, we planned various raids along the coast, including the one on PAG, and I took part in that. We did a recce first with an officer from the Yugoslav Archer, because, by the way, by this time, the Yugoslavs had stopped calling themselves partisans. They'd become the Yugoslav National Freedom, National Liberation Army, with partisan detachments. And one of their officers of the artillery unit went over with one of our chaps, an amazing character from the Raiding Support Regiment, called, I think his name was Bithel, Captain Paddy Bithel or something like that. He dropped him with a little dog on a separate parachute, and he had eventually had a battery of 75, Jeep-drawn 75s, and of course he joined us in this recce of the Pagana, the extreme end of Pagana, away from where the German garrisons were. And eventually we launched the attack, combined operation, 5,000 British troops with Yugoslav partisans. I acted as observation officer for the guns.
For the fall of shots.
I never had any experience of that before, but I did it anyway. Jerry was using 105 mortars to very good effect, because they're very good, as you probably know, with that sort of thing, and they were really playing merry hell with all of us. But eventually, the main town of Pag, called Pag itself, or Pag Island, surrendered. It fell and surrendered. They were dead all over the place. A lot of Yugoslavs, a lot of partisans were wounded too, because the Germans had discovered the only way to stop what they called, what the Yugoslavs called a Jurish, which is charge, was young boy and girls, by the way, partisan girl soldiers, was to aim heavy machine guns at the belly and below. Otherwise, if they tried to hit them in the chest, they would carry on with the last gasp and throw their grenades through the slit of the pillboxes that the Germans had built all over the place, so that they killed Germans even though they were themselves about to die. Fantastic card. After that, I had various jobs all over the place. Then finally, when war was ended, my final act of almost action was to go up with a New Zealand captain. Now, I better go back a bit. When we entered Trieste finally, I was told from Corps to join Colonel Clark, Major Harrison, at an airport, an airstrip that the partisans had built for us, and to go hotfoot to Trieste, where the partisans were already in possession. For political reasons, this was essential. So I joined Harrison and Clark, and we got to Trieste. I was then told to take over the ex-consulate, British consulate. Had to turf out an Italian family who'd taken up residence there, missed all their protestations. We did, and then I was joined by Colonel, well, I knew him as Dusty Miller, who was put in charge of the mission. Now, after a while, they withdrew all... Well, I was appointed as OC, a bit of a joke, this OC, 13 Corps Liaison Detachment of the 8th Army, through which all other missions in Yugoslavia were withdrawn. I had equipment, jeeps galore, guns, compasses, God, you name it, I had them, which I frankly distributed to the partisans with GHQ approval. So eventually I was left up in a little place called Kostanjevica, just above Trieste, with about 30-35 detachment of liaison people. And I was appointed to act as British liaison officer with the Yugoslav Brigade, who were then under the command of 13 Corps by agreement between Field Marshal Alexander and Marshal Tito, after all the troubles, because the partisans, were called the Yugoslavs, had eventually to withdraw from Trieste. They were there a week before the 8th Army came in. I know, because I was with them. They did withdraw to Zone B. We had Zone A and Zone B, and Zone A was in Venezia Giulia, where the Yugoslav Brigade was, of course, and General Sir John Harding down at 13 Corps headquarters in Duino Castle.
We've had a great deal in recent years about the controversy of Yugoslavs being sent back to Yugoslavia.
Now, I knew nothing about this. I knew nothing about this. I read the subsequent disputes by Count Tolstoy and so on and so forth. I've got Macmillan's book of references, you know, his memoirs, where he, of course, played a very large part in the Yugoslav affairs at that time. I still don't know the strength of it. I have no way of knowing or of disproving what's been claimed, but I find it hard to believe, because again and again, I must tell you, when we went up to take the surrender of 2,000 German troops, I meant to go back on this, hold up above Kostanjevica. When I was down at... let me go back. When I was down at Trieste, I was called to Brigadier Gentry, who was in command of the troops that had entered that part of the world, the advance guard of the 8th Army, and told that I would have a very onerous job to do. Apparently, a New Zealand captain had come bustling down to him, said that he had come across from Italian territory to around Trieste, or up to around Kostanjevica, Opatija, that's the word, Opatija. Above, not the Opatija, the, you know, the big plaza, the big local holiday place, but another little village above the hill, where he'd got a Tiger tank buried down, hull down, and 2,000 Germans were holding out. Now, they were being besieged by a partisan, or Yugoslav army, I don't know, company or group or detachment or something, and the German officer had called out to him that he wanted to surrender to British troops. And the partisans said, no, by agreement between your Field Marshal Alexander and our Marshal Tito, all surrenders over a certain line have to be to Tito's forces, which was quite serious, as a matter of fact. Anyway, he said, you better go up with this officer, said to me, and tell this German colonel that either he surrenders within an hour or I'll send my tanks to winkle him out. It is quite true. He said, there is an agreement. We cannot take surrenders over a certain line. So up I went. I left my jeep down below. When we got up there, we had a four-way parley again. There was a German colonel, a German captain who was a medical officer who spoke fluent English. There was the big burk of his, I called him, moustaches, the Montenegrin colonel, big fellow. And there was me. And, of course, the New Zealand captain in the background who couldn't take part in the discussions. So the talk went backwards and forwards. The German said that although he knew certain German Nazis had committed atrocities, his men had never done anything like that, but he was frightened of repercussions. The Yugoslav colonel said, look, tell him, he said, that Marshal Tito said, we answer with our heads if we permit any atrocities against enemy troops. Okay, that was that point. Then he said, could he and his officers keep their sidearms? Yes, of course they can keep their sidearms. Could he and his officers keep their personal baggage? Yes, of course they could keep their baggage. And finally, he had 200 wounded in the hotel in the hospital in Gorizia, which was a nearby place, just above Trieste, and a lot of nurses there. And there were these nurses, a lot of these nurses were with him, really very white-faced in the background. And the Yugoslav colonel said, look, tell him we don't do what your chaps do to some of our people. We do not ill-treat anybody, male or females, and especially nurses. Said they'd be quite safe. Your wounded will be moved down to Trieste Hospital. We will take over the hospital for our wounded, and that will be that. And eventually, after a lot of further discussion, they agreed. And of course the Germans had to pile their arms and go off. Now, the USAF colonel pushed off with his entourage. The New Zealand captain shot off, leaving me alone, because I got no jeep. Mine was down at Trieste, you know, GHQ. And I walked slowly between these 2,000 troops, like, all unshaven, looking very ferocious, and I could understand a bit of German. Some were saying, no, one last brief for you to hear, the Führer, you know. I thought, oh, God, did I come right to what was it, June, I think, by then, 1946, I'm going to get it this way, you see.
So, June?
Was it June or May?
V-Day was May.
I can't remember the exact date, you know, but it was just before the end of... Well, no, we had to tell them that Hitler had committed suicide, that Goering...
Well, that was the end of April.
Yes, that's right. Well, then, that's right, of course, yes.
The end of April, beginning of May time.
That's right, yes. Anyway, as I said, they finally agreed, and off they went. Now, I walked slowly down, I lit a cigarette very nonchalantly, not treating anyone near as cool as I may have looked. Frankly, very unspoken, I scuttled like hell down to get the last Yugoslav jeep just about to disappear, and I got back to GHQ. That was it. That was my last bit of actual action. Mind you, in the meantime, I must say, before I went back into Yugoslavia, I forgot to tell you, I was sent up to join what they call Rover Paddy. Now, you don't know what paddies are, do you?
Just before you say that, though, how were the Germans who surrendered treated?
Oh, very well. Very well. Extremely well. In all my experience, all those that I saw, they were quite pleased. In fact, very glad that the war was over and to be out of it. In fact, I had a German work party sent up to me after the war, they'd all surrendered, in the charge of a young sergeant who spoke fluent English, and I used to have him in for coffee and so on, and cigarettes in my little... I requisitioned a house, the house of the girl eventually married my lance corporal, for my old corporal, funnily enough. In fact, she's still in life. He just died, but she's still around, the girl, Pauline. Anyway, I said to him, what I couldn't understand was, how could a nation like the Germans, who produced Goethe, Thomas Mann, various other excellent writers and composers, Beethoven, the whole Mozart, the whole load of them. Well, Mozart was Austrian, wasn't he? But anyway, all of the German composers. I said, I couldn't understand with their philosophers. The Marxist amongst them and so on. This wealth of thought that the Germans have given the world. How could you behave like this? Well, he said, I was inducted into the Hitler Youth Corps when I was a small boy. He said, I knew nothing else. I was told that the Russian communists were all bastards and that they must be fought and extinguished, exterminated. All gypsies must be exterminated. Slavs are not much good. Jews certainly must go. So we knew nothing else. And I said, oh, well, I suppose it makes sense.
So I interrupted you with you going back to, I think, some operations that you did in Italy. Is that what you were going to
do? Oh, well, I went up to join Rover Paddy. I was up on the Italian front in 1944.
What was Rover Paddy?
Well, they had four rovers. They were supposed to be very mobile units, observation units, in no man's land. And I was sent to Rover Paddy. Actually, they were far from mobile. I mean, we were ensconced in a farmhouse, and we did our observation from the roof, you know, the attic of the farmhouse.
Who did these mobile units come under?
Oh, Eighth Army. Wait, I'm sorry, yes, I was Eighth Army by this time. I forgot to say that.
And so was this 44 or 45?
This was 44. 44, yes, before I went into Yugoslavia again.
This was in the winter?
Oh, yes, very much in the winter. It was absolutely freezing. God, was it freezing. It was that bitter winter.
Were these intelligence gathering units?
Oh, yes, we had Mae West with us. You know, that's military area interpretation West, because we had the Americans on the other side called East. And they, frankly, didn't do a very good job. I don't know what I can say this on this thing. The idea was to get photographic planes to fly up and down, overlapping by 5% to cover terrain. Then they would go back to base with all their to a mobile unit. Mobile photographic unit, whereby these photographs would be multiplied, run off in hundreds and hundreds, and they were dished out to right down to platoon commanders, you know, sergeants, corporals. Now we also had this interpretation unit, which I was one for a while, where we had these stereoscopes, and I've got my pair next door. Anything I've nicked from the army, and when you put two photographs together under the stereoscope. I was amazed. You'd see machine gun snouts coming up at you out of nothing. Whereas look with a naked eye and you couldn't see anything. I couldn't believe it. I had a lovely time, you know, doing this thing. And we apparently had to teach the Americans how to do it because they had gaps when they didn't do the 5% overlap under Mark West, Mark Carr, you know, who was commander of the American army in the east side of Italy.
And so you were gathering intelligence, were you? Or interpreting?
Well, yes, because Fibonacci Alexander said he was not going to waste lives as were wasted in the First World War. No names, no petrol, you know. And he was accused in England of going too slowly up Italy. Well, he had damn good reason. What with the weather, which was absolutely atrocious, you know, and the rivers to be crossed and all in flood, and the cold, which has been absolutely intense, he went slowly. So these photographs would be dished out, and some of them were given to the RAF, the Spitfires and the rocket firing Hurricanes. And, for instance, they would come over, and this is where the observation unit comes in. They would fly over us in the walkie-talkie, and with their usual clipped RAF accents would say, what's the target, old boy? And we'd say, second road, third house, second floor, fourth room from the left. Hey, Roger them out, and they go in, and they fire their hurricane, and they blast these bloody places one by one. That's how they cleared the way up Italy. And they saved a lot of lives doing this. Hell of a lot of lives.
So
because they had these photographs which had been taken by aerial reconnaissance to show them exactly where things were. You know, they could pinpoint them, get the coordinates, bomb the hell out of them.
Whereabouts was this Paddy Rover group of yours?
Well, we were in between our main army, which I think was in Bologna, and we were in between Forli. We'd just taken Forli. The 8th Army had just taken Forli, and we were in between Forli and I think it was Bologna. I'm trying to recall, a long time ago. We were a very immobile unit. We had a RAF for, I think it was a Winko in charge, and various army personnel and naval as well, and because I was there, I was a captain by this time. I was there as well. And because I was joined in by a chap called Spencer Ashworth, the relation of the Churchill family, an excellent fellow who told me all he wanted to do was become a gentleman farmer after the war, and I hope he has, dear old Spencer Ashworth. Anyway, he's with another Rover Paddy. They had Rover Paddy, Rover Frank, and two other Rovers that I can't remember the names of, four altogether, doing this observation job in no man's land, all in no man's land. And of course, you know, we used to get shelled. I mean, you know, the old Jerry would send over a salvo every so often. He'd cover an area, and if you know what German artillery people are like, they're very, very good. They blanket the area, square by square. Rather frightening at times, but you know, we survived, obviously. Then eventually I was called back. When I got to Rome, I went down with very bad bronchitis. I had a temperature of 104, because I'd had no greatcoat, you see. All I had was an open sheet with no hood, and just a trench coat, which wasn't really warm enough. Anyway, I got this bronchitis. I was in Rome hospital for two weeks, then was ordered back to Bari and told I was going into Zadar. And you know the story from then on. Well, finally, when we finally got to Trieste, I've already explained to you, after this initial business with taking the surrender of these last 2,000 Germans, I was there then liaising with the partisans. I took Colonel Dapchevich, one of their Yugoslav generals, to Venice and his party on a sightseeing tour with a five-star launch. I had quite a nice time in some ways, except that I couldn't ride, which I wanted to do. Everybody else was getting horses, you know, from the remount section. I was too damn busy. Either I was getting Yugoslavs out of our hands, our patrol's hands, or our chaps' hands out of their hands, because there's a lot of friction going on the line. The Morgan Yovanovitch line, the blue line, in between Zone A and Zone B. I'm thinking back, you know. I had one unhappy job. I got very friendly with a Russian colonel in charge of a rehabilitation unit. Now, our lads seemed to think that this fellow was acting as an espionage group, you see, and I was told to escort him back to the blue line, to get him back into Zone B. And when I got there one morning, he was sitting in his shirt sleeves with his major and his captains and two or three girls, Ukrainians, who'd been released from prisoner of war camps and so on, who were part of the rehabilitation scheme, naturally. And they were all eating strawberries. And going, "Ah, Tovarish Alexander," he said, "come and join us, you know. Vodka." I said, "No, I've not come on social media this time, and I'm afraid it's business." And I told him, he said, "They must be joking. So I'm no spy." I said, "Well, I can't argue about that. I have a job to do, as you will understand. You have 1 hour to pack up and get out." And he did, and of course I had six burly MPs outside in their truck, didn't I, their 1500-weight infantry truck. We took him to the blue line. He cuddled me, kissed me, and all the officers of the thing hugged me, kissed me. Oh, Stetter, they said, you know, big pity, you know, not necessary.
Stetter?
Stetter is pity. Stetter, pity. Stetter is damage or pity. Kakma Stetter. What a pity, you know, such good friends. And I said, well, I have a job to do, you know. I have every sympathy with you, but I have a job to do as a British officer, and I have to say goodbye.
We so shook the British hands. Forces felt he was in, he shouldn't be in that place?
Oh, they said he was conducting a spying group, you see. This rehabilitation unit of his was just a camouflage. This is what they told me. Brigadier Airy, who was the intelligence senior officer down at Corps. I had one interesting run-in with the... Well, in which Brigadier was involved. Can I go back a bit?
Yes.
When you know, everything was over and we got the Yugoslav wounded in the Goritza hospital and the Germans had gone out, they put an RAMC lieutenant, doctor, in charge of the hospital, and he was liaising with me. And he came to me one day and he said, look, he said, Alex, he said, there's something I've got to tell you about. He said, you remember that big strapping peasant girl you saw the last day of the war, before war was declared officially ended, you know, the armistice? She got machine gunned in the thigh, one of the last attacks. I said, yes, she made two of me, didn't she? Great big strapping girl. Because, I mean, I'm not very tall. And I've never been more about 9 stone odd. He said, she's never really healed, you know. I said, what do you mean? He said, well, she's got a wound, one of them was just off centre, and it was superating, and it wouldn't stop.
On the inside of her thigh.
Mm. And he said, now, the thing that would cure all her trouble is penicillin. I said, well, go and get some. He said, I can't, they won't give it to me. I said, but there's an agreement between Field Marshal Alexander and Tito that they were to have all that they require and to pay in gold after the war. There's an agreement signed and sealed. He said, does it make any odds with the colonel, the Dadoff colonel down there? I said, deputy assistant director, you know, ordnance supplies and so on. So I said, I'll settle this. So I got in my bloody jeep, and I was really angry, you know. I knew a captain, of course. Bowled off down to Corps, 13 Cordina Castle, saw this colonel, and I really blasted him. I said, what the hell do you mean by it? He said, who do you think you're talking to, young man? You know, because I forgot myself. I was insubordinate, and I was out of order. And in the middle of this heated discussion, up comes Brigadier Airy, who had dropped a rank to take on the job of the Intelligence Corps senior officer. He said, what's all this about? What's all this about? And I explained. And he said, well, he said, for a start, young man, don't let me hear you talking to a senior officer like that again. I said, no, sir. Sorry, sir. And he said, new colonel, he said, you take this officer, you give him what he wants now. And he spoke just like that, you know. So I sort of apologised for my outburst. Because I'm a bit like that. That's my Balkan, my Serbian temperament, I suppose. And off we went. But he gave me a little tiny pinch of penicillin. That was nothing. And a little screw of paper. He said, that'll be enough. It's 250,000 units there. I said, okay, sir, thank you very much. Sorry about the outburst, sir. All right, sir, forget it. Saluted, off I went. I gave it to this RMC court lieutenant, and about a week later he said, do you want to see a miracle? He said, come up and see that girl. So I went up with him, and there was this girl walking about as large as life, completely recovered by a little tiny spot of penicillin.
Did she seem grateful to the British Army?
Oh, yeah. Great, great girl she was. She went back to a village or something. I don't know what happened after that. But there's another example.
That was in 45, was it?
That was, 45, right when the war ended, you see. Because she'd been wounded at the last one of the last attacks of the war.
If we can just say a little bit more about the PAG raid. I know you said it only lasted a day, but we didn't really say very much about it. But if you can give some more detail.
Well, shall I mention the 5,000... force, the British force that
yes,
was with it?
Please.
Combined forces, yes. You tell me when you want to start.
Yeah, tell me now, please.
Well, when it decided to launch the raid on Pag Island, which the Germans were still holding out on, we had 5,000 British forces, Army, Air Force and Naval, plus a large Yugoslav force cooperating, all of them, from we had two cruisers involved, the Orion and the Delhi, which transported troops and equipment. And when we came to land, we found that the RAF had bombed the original landing spots, the jetties, so that we had great big vast blocks of concrete all on edge. So we had laboriously and very precariously to tread our way carrying the WT, in my particular section, all the WT equipment, because we had to set up signals for the whole effort. And then I say the attack started, and I then became observation officer for the combined lot with the Iranian support regiment section, that was a battery that was there, and the Yugoslavs. I quite enjoyed that. Up 50, down 50, left 50.
So that must have been about the most dangerous part of the war for you in that attack.
In a way, I mean, I was shelled. When I was with Rover Paddy, we were shelled, but nothing ever hit us. So it was the most dangerous part of the war. The most dangerous part of the war was me dropping out of a plane because I'm scared of heights, and today. I was scared stiff. I always thought the damn parachute wouldn't open.